Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's considered a central tenet of America that there are no permanent classes, that since the first European settlement, upward social mobility is a given and available to anyone willing to work hard enough to achieve it. My guest today says not so fast. Permanent class structure has existed from our founding right up to today. Class divisions were at work in deciding who came to, quote, settle, unquote, America, and colonists quickly embraced English class divisions, devising a small class to rule and own land and a much larger lower class to work and sustain them. And it's been ever so since, from colonial days through the westward expansion, the Civil War, and today's 1%. Historian Nancy Eisenberg has written a provocative book on class with an equally provocative title, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. In it, she probes founding fathers like Franklin, Jefferson, and Thomas Paine's view on class, reveals that the Civil War was as much about class as it was race, and how class is affecting our political life today. Nancy Eisenberg is a former University of Tulsa professor, currently the Williams Professor in American History at LSU, and the author of Fallen Founder, The Life of Aaron Burr. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Nancy Eisenberg, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
This book takes aim at one of the central myths of the American psyche, sort of our American story, and that is that America is not a class-bound society. Why did you decide to write about this?
Well, I think there are a lot of different reasons. I mean, my last book that I wrote with my partner, Andrew Burstein, was on Madison and Jefferson, and I got really interested in Jefferson's ideas of breeding and how central that was to his thinking. And then I was also deeply interested in this whole problem about how you see politicians over and over again sort of celebrating the American dream, but then it's really never backed up by any facts or evidence. So I decided to actually look at this problem as a historian, and the most important connection that I uncovered in my early research was to see that even though the term white trash doesn't really first appear in print until the 1820s, there's a much older term, a term that goes all the way back to one of the leading Elizabethan colonial promoters, a man by the name of Richard Hakluyt, who basically argued that the New World was for dumping the refuse, dumping the surplus population, people who were just burdening the English economy. And the term that he used to describe the poor was waste people. And that's really where this idea of white trash comes from. It comes from an English notion of the poor, not specifically, as we tend to think of it, as mainly a Southern idea for describing the rural poor.
And I really thought of that epithet, white trash, as sort of a 20th century term because of, you know, the huge racial divides that were apparent well through the 19th century. And when you begin to see the move towards equality of races, that's when that term picks up. But I was surprised to know that there were a whole range of terms used for this landless, lower class European that apparently England was very anxious to ship to the New World.
Yeah, and I think we have to realize the idea that at the time of the American Revolution, and this is part of the mythology that even people like Thomas Jefferson wanted to perpetuate, but the idea that we broke free from the class system, that was a wish. That wasn't actually a reality, because at the time of the Revolution, in Jefferson's own Virginia, 40% of the white population, the white male population, essentially were landless tenant farmers. And as I also like to point out, is that even by the 1930s, still 40% of the population are landless tenant farmers. And two-thirds are in the South, two-thirds are white. Because I think one of the problems we face is we tend not to think about the rural poor because we don't see them. And there were sociologists who began to focus on the idea of urban poverty, and we tend to associate it with African Americans, but that misses this really long history of white poverty, and that the idea of getting rid of the poor naturally. We took that English idea of dumping the poor somewhere else, and this exact same idea was used for opening up the backcountry, opening up the frontier, that somehow, and this is an idea that Benjamin Franklin promoted, that if your family's not making it, you are failing economically, then you should migrate, you should move. And what the founders really promised was horizontal mobility, the ability to keep moving, not the guarantee that that you were able to move up the social ladder.
Wasn't that sort of inherent in moving across the country? I was reading this part of it. You know, if you take the idea that most of the Europeans that came to this country were landless in some way, there was, you know, this division of class as some acquired land and others didn't. And the idea that by being physically mobile and moving across the country, you would again sort of subdivide this landless lower white class.
Yeah, I think what we forget, I mean, we have other myths that I highlighted at the beginning. Not
it's
only
true.
Did we imagine that the New World was empty, when, of course, true. We knew there were, you know, vast numbers of Native Americans, that it was a wilderness. That term waste people comes from a wasteland. It was a land that was left fallow. But the problem with even that is that clearly, as people moved west, the land was not an open space. It was not an equal playing field. Large land speculators had the advantage. They owned the best land. They had the inside track with the land office. And squatters, as I highlight, squatters and crackers were people who were vilified. If they tried to squat down on land they didn't have title to, they were physically removed by the government, or they were, you know, chased off from the land because they didn't have a claim to it. So this is part of the problem, is that mobility wasn't just about opportunity. It was about a class that was struggling to survive and faced serious disadvantages in trying to own land, in acquiring land, because initially when land was sold from the federal government, it was at prices that the poor couldn't even come close to paying for. So the battle over the land is a continuing issue, and that's one of the things I stress, is the importance of land ownership as a measure of class. And that's still true today, because we still look at home ownership as a means of defining being part of the middle class.
Yeah, and it's still a upward mobility sort of enabler, because our tax laws, everything is based on real estate being something to be celebrated. And, you know, if you have a person with a mortgage and a person that's renting, the person that's renting pays more taxes.
Right. And that's really important, because, I mean, we do have, you know, because of the federal government in the post-World War II period, and this comes out of New Deal policies, when the government began, you know, insuring mortgages for homes, meant that banks were more willing to loan money, so you had an increase in the number of homeowners. You had the GI Bill, which provided money for college education for veterans. This is really when we had the first stable middle class, because of what the federal government is doing. But at the exact same moment, the problem with suburbia is that suddenly the class status of the occupants determines the value of the land. And this is why you had all the controversy in suburbia, where there was racial segregation, there was redline districting, there were, you know, secret covenants where white owners were not allowed to sell to black families. And then on top of that, zoning laws are all about dividing people by class. So class has a geography, and this is even more true today, the way in which where you live, the value of your land, the property you own, is all controlled by a way to preserve the class value, and that people want to live in neighborhoods. They want to move their families not only to safe neighborhoods, but neighborhoods that have all the amenities, and that's a class privilege. So if we did a whole map across the United States, we could divide the country in towns, regions, neighborhoods based on the class status, not only the racial status, but the class status of the occupants of those neighborhoods.
It's interesting you mentioned that, the real estate covenants and the abilities or the inability of banks to loan money to various communities. We just had a guest about a month or two ago who is one of those folks that are coming into central Detroit and trying to rebuild Detroit. She said in Detroit City proper, 90% of the real estate transactions are cash transactions, because no bank will loan any money within Detroit. Only 10% of the real estate transactions involve a mortgage, because banks will not lend money.
Right.
And so how do you rebuild a city when the banks are not participating whatsoever?
No, I mean, I think that's really an important example. I mean, again, it's a privilege. We can say, well, the banks don't want to take the risk, et cetera, but they just reinforce the class inequality when they're unwilling to try to help rebuild a neighborhood. And I think that's one of the real problems we face today, that, you know, everyone talks about the Rust Belt, and I was thinking about this yesterday. You know, it's actually a really, really hostile term, because it's about, you know, rusted, decrepit areas. But how did they get that way? You know, who's responsible for when areas become economically depressed? And it's what you're talking about, banks, it's about companies. And then the idea, I mean, that political commentators say today, and this is what Kevin Williamson said in the National Review, well, if your town is dying, just pack your bags and move on. I couldn't believe he said that. I mean, it's like coming right out of the 19th century. Just move on. Well, what if you've invested in a house? You can't just move on. What if you have neighbors and friends and family members? So that resorting to that old solution, to me, was really disturbing, because I think that we have to understand that whether it's politics, whether it's the legal system, that also creates opportunity and privilege that isn't equally available to all.
Now, it's really interesting you mentioned that. Your book gives a number of examples when politicians and policymakers refer to class. It's always put on the individual as opposed to a collective community. It's you don't have a job because you're too lazy to go out and get one. It's always on the individual. And that statement you just mentioned was, again, abandon community, go move somewhere else
right.
to find a job. That's a lot of times how politicians talk about it.
I talk about the group that the British and the English hated the most of the poor were vagrants, the mobile poor. And the trait that they said that the poor embodied was idleness. And if you think about the way they thought about idleness, they thought about the same way we think of an idling motor. Because actual vagrants could migrate as much as 60 miles a month. But they were seen as the equivalent of an idling motor, like they're producing energy, but it's contributing nothing to the economy. And this is, you know, to blame the poor, this is why I always like to mention that argument is used over and over again. Even people, I highlight people who move up the social ladder. I talk about in the 70s, they're the upscale rednecks. But they're looking back and down on the people who were left behind and somehow saying, well, we made it on our own when they didn't. You know, they had government assistance. But that tension, we forget that tension of moving into the middle class doesn't mean that everyone who moves up is empathetic toward the poor. They want to maintain those boundaries between themselves in order to distinguish why they were able to move up into the middle class. And just one more thing, the idea of blaming the poor, when did it not happen? It didn't happen during the Great Depression. And that's because by 1932, 20% of the population are out of work. You can't suddenly blame individuals when that portion of the population is out of work. So this is why in the Great Depression in the 30s, we have some of the smartest people who are really beginning to talk about class in a much more realistic fashion. Because you can't go back to the old tired myths when you see that 20% of your population is out of work.
And we also begin to examine the poor, too. People like Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, Alan Lomax going back with his recorders back into the hollows of Appalachia. All of a sudden, we're actually seeing these people for many times the first time.
Right, and that's, I think, also something that's really telling. I mean, we have to talk about the power of ideology, the power of culture. You know, those photographers in the 30s, and again, we're working for the federal government. And this is something that even goes back to Jacob Riis, who in the early 20th century, wrote, you know, How the Other Half Lives, and recorded on his photography, people living in poor tenements. On the one hand, we can say that those visual images are really powerful. They force people to confront the truths as opposed to the myths they want to believe in. But then we have kind of the other problem today, where the news media moves from scandal to scandal, and we see a crisis, and then people become numb to it, that they're not responding in a more empathetic or compassionate way. So this is the whole problem, why we have to actually take look at cultural media and the changes in mediums that are used to tell the story about our class system and be very critical of them, and not just sort of accept that, well, this is the whole story or this is the answer that we can rely on, particularly when we look at television news.
My guest today is historian Nancy Eisenberg, the Williams Professor of History at LSU. She's a former professor at the University of Tulsa. Her new book is titled White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. It's published by Viking. And in the book, you go right from the writings of the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, who had this notion of women that will enrage many today. in terms of his slaves and his female black slaves as basically a factory.
Right.
To make people. And Franklin would also talk in this way, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's the emphasis on breeding. And this is something we have to understand. I mean, in that period, the people who talked about demography, and this is something Franklin and both Jefferson believed, that the strength in the nation was in the number of its peoples. That was a British idea. So when Jefferson, this is something he said in his inaugural address, that somehow the power of the United States lay in its future. And one of the things that he argued was that that power came from the ability of women to produce more and more children. Each generation will grow bigger and bigger. And we tend to think of demography in abstract terms and numbers, but it's women who have to produce those children. And they just assumed that this was a given. This was the role of women. And Jefferson is very explicit, as other historians have said, about saying that female slaves were more valuable than male slaves because they produced a commodity, which were children. And this is another theme that I do highlight in this book, the importance of children as a measure of, were crucial in defining slavery itself, and they're crucial in defining how we measure one's class status. Because I go all the way back to a law that was passed in 1662 in Virginia. This is a law that said you are a slave when your mother is a slave, and therefore you are the offspring of a female slave. What is that doing? That's actually saying that female slaves, the matrilineal lineage, is what determines your status as being a slave. And we have to realize how important that is, because this is part of this larger argument that I make about how Americans didn't get rid of their class system. We know they didn't get rid of their slave system. And often what intertwined race and class is this emphasis on pedigree, on using, analogizing animal and human stocks, the emphasis on lineage. These are kind of old British class terms for distinguishing the aristocracy from other classes, but they also reinforce the kind of racial ideologies that become popular in the 19th century as well. So yes, breeding and reproductive politics that eventually ends up producing the eugenics movement. I mean, what was the eugenics movement about? Which we think of the eugenics movement as something that the Germans used, the Nazi Germans. Where did they get those ideas from? They got it from experts in the United States and Great Britain, which were the foremost leaders of the pseudoscience of eugenics. And that was about having pedigree charts, the same way you have charts for a racehorse to determine whether you are part of a valuable lineage, or as Theodore Roosevelt said, the elites should carry on their stock, their bloodlines, and that the inferior people should not, quote, reproduce their kind. And this wasn't a minority movement, because by 1931, 27 states had eugenically informed sterilization laws on the books.
You know, you were talking about how Jefferson and Franklin were talking about this idea of breeding to build a nation. But it was also, you know, if 40% of the population of Virginia were landless tenant farmers, those were not people who were going to vote. Those were people who were not going to have power. Okay. Women were not going to have power. Any people of color were not going to have any power. They were set up as a class to be ruled, really.
Right, and that's the thing we forget. When the founders talked about liberty, they didn't mean liberty for all. They essentially meant that to have true freedom, and this is a very British idea, the idea that denying the poor the right to vote, that was a British idea, part of the British common law, was rooted in the idea that if you're not a property owner, if you're not capable of sustaining yourself and being a worthwhile citizen who has a stake in society, then you didn't deserve the right to vote, because there was a great fear that the poor would be manipulated, their votes would be bought. So when they talked about liberty, you had to be a landowner. This is kind of rooted in 18th century thought, and it was something that people like Thomas Jefferson fully subscribed to. So, and we know it's one of the reasons that women were denied the vote until 1920, because women were all supposedly married, and therefore if they didn't own property, which also comes from the common law, they were not seen as independent. So this is one of the things we have to realize, that American democracy was never really a democracy. Throughout our long history, we've had numerous efforts to disenfranchise voters for a variety of different reasons. And we also have this problem where when we try to understand the founders and try to understand their thinking, that they're not us, that essentially they lived in an 18th century world, and they did not in any way assume that everyone should be equal. They sort of were more than willing to use British thinking as a way to justify class differences and racial differences.
But yet the founding documents were written in a way to be interpreted to expand that definition, though.
Right. I mean, if we think about the Declaration of Independence and the idea of all men are created equal, although, as we know, Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1848 changed it and said it had to be all men and women, and there was no way Jefferson believed in women's equality at all, and they're over half the population. But that's the problem. I mean, you can read that document and say, well, is he talking about now, or is he talking about, when he even says the pursuit of happiness, is he talking about something to be obtained in the future?
Yeah.
That's the problem when you write in an abstract way. It can be interpreted a variety of different ways. And then we always have to compare those documents, those writings, with what's the reality on the ground. Because that's what I do with Jefferson. At the same time he's writing the Declaration of Independence, how is he actually changing the conditions, the legal conditions, in Virginia at that time? Where does he think change is possible? And the one that I really like to highlight is that he tried to find a way to extend public education to people who were poor. But when he wrote about it, he described this as a bill that would be taking a few young men from poorer families, and if they prove to be capable of education, that they will get some kind of state funding. Just a few. And he referred to them as being raked from the rubbish. And there's that trash allusion again. And when we see that, this is equally important. Because you are willing to fund a few people, the rest of those people are still rubbish. And then the irony of this is that Jefferson's educational bill was rejected because the elites in Virginia didn't even want to pay for a few people to have a chance to move up the social ladder.
My guest today is historian Nancy Eisenberg. Her new book is titled White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. I do want to talk a little bit about your account of the Civil War, which you say was really fought as much on class lines as racial lines. It was a struggle to shore up both a racial and class hierarchy. How did class enter into the Civil War?
Yeah, I think this is the one thing that we tend to forget about the Civil War, is that if we look at the social structure of the southern states, and there are differences between the northern states and the southern states, and I highlight how some northern states stayed in the Union or had people who joined the Union because of they had a different economic and racial composition in terms of how dependent they were on slavery. But one of the things that I highlight is that the tensions, the way in which the fears of elite Confederates, they were not only afraid of losing slavery, they really, at the beginning when Lincoln is getting elected, they're afraid that if Lincoln wins, that means that you might have the growth of industry in the South, and that would overrun the South, and you'd have poor workers from the North, immigrants from the North, who'd be swamping into the southern states, which would create to them, would make the elite, planter elite, a minority, more of a minority than they already were. And they also were very afraid that Lincoln was going to attract support from poor whites, the landless poor whites, that he was going to promise them land. And they were right, because this is at the same time when the Homestead Act is being promoted. And that Homestead Act that was going to provide land to the poor was not passed until after the Civil War began, because Southern politicians again and again rejected passing that law. So there were really serious class tensions. There were class tensions in the Confederate Army. We know this, that the elite officers looked down on people who were conscripted into the Army. Many people who were conscripted would desert. So when we think about the Army, we have to realize that that reinforced a class social order. And we also have to recognize that from the very beginning, the North and the South, the leading ideologues were seeing these as two competing class orders. The South was defending itself as built on slavery and arguing that slavery was actually provided a more stable society than in the North. And I highlight in great detail the argument of James Henry Hammond, who was South Carolina's leading pro-slavery intellectual, and he coined the term mudsill. And that's one of the key terms of the Civil War, where he argued that, and this, the house analogy, the same one Lincoln uses, was very popular for Confederates as well, but the idea that the mudsill was the base of society. These were the people you exploited, so that the more superior people on top would be able to advance. And he was very clear about this. And he's using a class-based system. He said that the South was superior because we kept only people of African-American descent on the bottom. And then when he looked north, he says, look, you're exploiting your own kind of people. You're exploiting people of your own race. And then went on to say, you can't even give them the vote. So he was predicting that in the North, they were going to have a class revolution.
Interesting.
And that fear of, and this is sort of, you have two very powerful metaphors. The Republican Party is called the Black Republicans because they are seen as supporting of anti-slavery. But then they're also, there was one critic who wrote, they are more dangerous as Red Republicans, because James Hammond's saying, well, you're going to have a revolution in the North, and that's going to undermine the Union, you know, despite what the Confederacy does. And then you have the other critic who says, no, what Lincoln really wants to do is foment class rebellion in the South, increase those tensions between the planter elite and poor whites. And in fact, they weren't completely wrong about that, because people like Ulysses S. Grant were very aware that the South's sense of unity was seriously compromised because of the class differences. And at the beginning of the war, essentially Union generals felt that the planter elite should be blamed for the Confederacy, blamed for leaving the Union, and they should pay the price. They're the ones who should have their property confiscated. So these class tensions appear over and over again, not only in the rhetoric of, you know, Confederate leaders or Union generals and Republican politicians, but there's a reality on the ground in terms of how class did define Southern identity, because by the 1840s, the South has an increasingly large class divide between the planter elite and poor whites, the landless poor, and their population is growing at such a rate that even though there's widespread out-migration of poor whites into the West, their level of the population stays constant. So there's a real fear among Confederates, because they believe they're going to become a weak minority, and if the real democracy moved into the South, the poor whites are going to have a larger portion of the vote, and the planter elite are going to be dislodged and undermined. And they even anticipate that, well, the poor whites who are non-slave owners, you know, they might actually agree with Republicans that slavery works to their disadvantages and makes them poor, because the planter elite not only have all the political power, they have the best land. And owning slaves secures their superior class position.
Historian Nancy Eisenberg is the Harry Williams Professor in American History at LSU. She was former University of Tulsa professor as well. Her new book is titled White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.